Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is E.L. Doctorow, whose most recent book is a collection of five short stories, Sweet Land Stories, also the author of such novels as Ragtime, The Waterworks, City of God, Book of Daniel, Welcome to Hard Times, Loon Lake, World's Fair, Billy Bathgate, and so forth. E.L. Doctorow, your new book, let's start with talking about this collection of short stories. All of these stories appeared at one point or another in The New Yorker, is that correct?
Four of them did. One came out in the Virginia Quarterly Review. I haven't written that many stories. What happened was I was asked to edit an anthology of best short stories of 2000, and I read about 150 stories. You read them blind. You don't know who wrote them or where they published. And the ones I chose were by young writers, mostly, who were either newly arrived here or who were first-generation American. So they were from China and Korea and Japan and Eastern Europe, the Caribbean, Latin America. And they weren't writing the classic modern short story that you find in Dubliners, for instance, where the entry point is very close to the denouement and everything turns on the revelation, the revelatory moment or the epiphany that Joyce called it. These stories had some extension to them, and they hark back to the tales of the 19th century. And that opens up something for me. And I felt a little more comfortable as a novelist with a story that could go on for a while and not be built around a single scene, as it were. So these stories are a little longer than most stories are, I think. And at one point I thought of calling the book Little Novels because I felt very comfortable doing these pieces.
They're all, as opposed to City of God, very straightforward narrative. They all deal with themes in a very broad sense that we're dealing with today in terms of culture, in terms of criminality, I would say.
The first story is House on the Plains, about the mother and her son who, with some degree of self-righteousness, arranged to kill people in order to improve their own station in life. And I would think about the other stories rather thematically as about people who are not quite rooted and who wander around the country and keep looking for their own place, their place. So that all the stories together, although I didn't know this when I started, cover the entire geography of the country from Washington, D.C. to Alaska. They're all in states of longing, these characters, and I didn't realize this. I didn't write these stories with the idea of any kind of thematic connection among them. But when I finished, decided to put this book out, I took those stories and put them in the order in which they were written and published, and discovered that the major characters are women. It's a book about women, and where they're not the major characters, they are certainly the catalysts that create the crisis or get the action going.
They deal with not merely rootedness, but also lying. There's a lot of lying in the book, a lot of deceit. The Baby Wilson story about the kidnapping, certainly the first story. Walter John Harmon is a liar.
Well, he's a prophet. We never know if he's a liar or not.
Yeah, well, but you can kind of read between the lines.
The way to get that story done correctly was not to take a cynical attitude to
right.
this situation. People are very serious about religion in this country, and there's such a variety of religious expression that sometimes it takes the forms that it takes in this story. The basic principle of Walter John Harmon is that his followers give him all their sins of all the values that they have taken unto themselves during the course of their lives, they're now giving to him, including their money and their personal beings. He is a sense of sacrificial prophet because he won't go to the heavenly city, as he tells them. They will because they'll be pure, but he'll go down to hell.
He's a con man.
He may very well be. He does drive a Hummer, that's true.
He does drive a Hummer, and he's got the perfect con, which is I can do whatever bad things I want. I'm just taking care of your sins. Jolene Alife is a very sympathetic portrait of a woman who is struggling to make ends meet and wanders city to city, winds up with the wrong people. When you were writing it, it seemed that you had a huge amount of sympathy for her.
Yes, the answer is I agree with that. I found that it was not a one-sided portrait at all. The story begins with Jolene to get away from her foster parents who mistreat her. She marries a sweet, young, kind of stupid fellow in town who drives an oil delivery truck and lives with him and his uncle, and the disasters begin at that point in her life. So she's 15 when the story starts, and she's about 29 when it's finished. And during the course of her wanderings across the country and her different relationships she's involved with, she grows, she learns. And I've decided there's kind of gallantry to her. She wasn't merely a victim.
For me, reading Sweetland's stories was quite a shift from the book I'd read before, which was City of God, which is not a straightforward narrative by any means. I want to talk a little about City of God. There's a novelist in it named Everett who has some of E.L. Doctorow's background. There's also within it, at least through the first part of the book, the weaving of a Holocaust story told from the point of view of a child. There's the theft of a cross from a church in New York that winds up in a kind of alternative synagogue. There appears to be an autobiography of sorts of the philosopher Ludwig Wittgenstein, poetry based on Tin Pan Alley, and various philosophical discourses scattered throughout. What were the grounding principles behind the style and content of the book?
Well, the book is a collage, and it purports to be the daybook of a professional writer named Everett. And Everett basically records the life of his mind. He's always looking for material. And he hears about this large brass cross that was is stolen from an Episcopal church on the Lower East Side and ends up on the roof of a, as you call it, an alternative synagogue, a synagogue of evolutionary Judaism up on the Upper West Side. And he sort of makes friends with the Episcopal priest, Pemberton, and the rabbi later, Sarah Blumenthal. That's the sort of the spine of the book and the pursuit of this mystery of who took the cross and who put it on the roof of the synagogue is what keeps everything together. But Sarah has a father who is a child during the Holocaust, and Everett, learning this, imagines that man's life in a ghetto in Lithuania in the 1930s and 40s. He's involved in the writing of movies, so he talks a lot about movies. The poetry based on popular songs, Everett's game he plays with lyrics of standards like Stardust and Me and My Shadow. And he imagines something called the Midrash Jazz Quartet, which is a verbal equivalent of four musicians playing, but instead of playing music, they do riffs on the original lyric, just as jazz musicians do riffs on the original theme. So all of these things are swirling about in Everett's mind. He's a carrier of his own time. He's a carrier of all the terrible events, the history of his time, the culture. And that's why the book is the way it is. I have done other books that are collages in form. The Book of Daniel is like that. Loon Lake is like that. But I have also written linear materials such as Ragtime and Welcome to Hard Times and The Waterworks. You never know when you start exactly what the book has to be. You have to wait till it decides what it must do to work. So you don't try to make a book difficult or make it easy. You just have to make it work on its own terms.
How do you, as a writer, know that, when it's working? And how do you know when it's not?
You feel good or you feel bad.
That's it?
So it's very simple. What you have to learn is that the signs that something is not working are very small signs. And you mustn't overlook them. For instance, you can be reading through some pages that you've done, and you find yourself skipping over a paragraph because you want to get to the next one, which is more interesting to you. So why? What's happening there? It's a very small sign, but it can mean eventually throwing away 50 or 100 pages of text. But it all comes out of feeling. It all comes out of a sense you have of things. It's not even articulated particularly.
Is there a point where you look and go, gee, Everett, maybe he's too much like E.L. Doctorow, or aren't you working on that level at all?
No, of course every book encodes your own life.
Sure.
But if you use the word code, you see you're talking about something cryptic. and the code keeps changing, because all good code devisers know that you can't stay with the same code every time.
There's a quote in the middle of the book by Everett, and let me read you this quote, because given the fact that you've had several of your works translated into film, it's a curious statement. I wonder if it's just Everett or if it's also something that you agree with, which is, literary experience extends impression into discourse, film implodes discourse, and film language, in quotes, is an oxymoron.
Well, that's certainly Everett's point of view. I'm sort of leaning in that direction. It doesn't mean I scorn film or hate film, but it is a fact that watching a film is an act of inference. You learn what's going on from a lot of nonverbal signals that are given to you in terms of the lighting and the set and the position of the camera and the way the characters are dressed, the way their hair is dressed, and how they move their eyes. And before anyone says anything, as a director once told me, 95% of a scene is delivered, especially after you drop in the music, maybe 98% before the dialogue. So, yes, it's true that he has a love-hate relationship with film, Everett does. But I think that's not a bad analysis, actually. The trouble people have had making films of my books, everyone tells me how cinematic my stuff is, except directors. They know that it's difficult because a lot of the action is moral action. It's internal.
Right.
So the problem is always, how do you make this play? So you have a first-person narrator. You're looking at the world through that narrator's eyes, as in these stories of Sweetland Stories or Billy Bathgate, for instance. But in film, you can't do that. What you do in film is you watch people behave. It's just the reverse. You're on the outside looking at the person. So I feel about those films that three out of the four were pretty much failures. And the fourth is not quite a failure, although it messes up badly. But I'm fondest of that one. That's the film I made with Sidney Lumet based on the book of Daniel.
Daniel, that's with Timothy Hutton.
Yeah. There's some beautiful stuff in that picture, although it doesn't totally work. And, of course, it was economically an absolute disaster.
But Ragtime is the one that, I guess maybe it's just because of Cagney's appearance in it. You think that's a failure, then?
Well, you know, because he wanted to use Cagney and have the enormous publicity value of that, the part was expanded and so distorted the rest of the piece badly, because that's actually, in the book, a very small role. But that wasn't the only problem he made, the director. He was interested basically in the story of Coalhouse Walker and not particularly in anyone else. And if you pull out the threads of this tapestry, the whole thing collapsed, which this did. It got very heavy, sort of folded badly, I think. On the other hand, in reflection and having seen the musical version, I realized the Ragtime is not a realistic novel, but film is inevitably very literal. The presumption is you're watching something that's actually happening. And someone's on a stage singing about his feelings, and props drop down from the ceiling and sets change in front of your eyes. You don't have that burden of realism, you see. So the movie had to somehow convert a non-realistic novel, an impertinent kind of highly satirical riff, into a realistic account, epic story, and it just didn't work. I've had some interest from film people in a couple of these stories, in Sweetland Stories, and it might actually be possible to make a decent film or two out of some of this material. But I would warn whoever these people are that the stories are tricky, and there's a lot in them that doesn't quite meet the eye. These characters live in their own universe.
Right. I was thinking in particular the lawyer who tells the story, the first-person story of Walter John Harmon. If you turn that into third person, what the reader gleans on his own or on her own, such as who Harmon is and what is actually happening in this cult, if you see it straightforward, it loses that completely.
Yeah, it does. The voices of these people are how the stories are written. And you can't write a piece until you have its voice. And certainly in the case of Walter John Harmon, the lawyer cultist, who eventually becomes the leader after the prophet disappears, is the main character of the story.
This brings up something that I've been trying to puzzle through in talking to various writers, which is the case of what is voice. And I've asked several people what that is. Ethan Kanan teaches about voice, saying it's the most important thing there is for a writer to learn. And some people give me a completely different impression of what they think voice is.
It's the language you find. It's the diction that characterizes the speaker. And in the third person, it characterizes the mind of the character you're writing about. It's that simple. But the language you find precedes any intention you have. In this story of Baby Wilson, Lester, who's talking, wakes up at noon as the woman who he's living on, because that's the kind of guy he is, walks in with the newborn and claims it's their baby. What he does is he gets out of bed and puts on his jeans and a fresh shirt and goes to the Frigidaire and gets beer. You know that what Lester is in three sentences. At least I did. And the story just unfolds from that. He has a certain way of talking. Earl, the young boy whose mother likes to kill off immigrant men who want to marry her, has a certain diction, a certain controlled vocabulary that defines him. So a voice is two things. It's what you hear of a character's being, A, and B, what you convert into the necessary diction to bring that character on the page.
I keep wondering when I recall from the time I read Ragtime, and I think it may be one of the reasons why the movie doesn't work and parts of the musical, I think, do, is because the title of the book itself gives us a sense of the voice.
Yeah, it probably does. In the case of novels, more than stories, titles are generative, and you use them up as you go along and then find more titles. And then the one you end up with at the end of the book becomes the title of the book. And that's the way it happened with Ragtime.
When I was watching the musical, I kept thinking, because it begins in a ragtime era and ends in a jazz era, that ragtime, the beat, the sense of ragtime, cannot be at the end of the musical. And yet it seems to me that as it gets there, it seems to lose something.
What I remember is the reprise when the actors come out for their bows and the orchestra goes into a pretty fast rag. I can't speak in defense of the musical because I didn't write the music or the lyrics.
Well, you work closely with Terrence McNally.
I gave them a lot of notes, yeah. Yeah. They listened for a while, but as the piece developed and the notes got more detailed, they listened less and less. But for a while there, I think I was a pretty good navigator. And when they ran into trouble, they went right back to the book. And I was very gratified by that. And also by Terrence's use of lines from the book in his libretto.
What was the sense of your notes to Ahrens and Flaherty and McNally on Ragtime?
It was to make sure that various strands of the plot were given equal attention, and that having experienced the movie treatment, I was very anxious that the three families be given their just due, as they are in the book. Because basically what happens is the three families are destroyed and the remnants of the three come together as one family at the end. And then I thought, somewhere there should be a song about something, and I thought Tata should sing a song about how he got to be a film director. And Lynn wrote wonderful lyrics for that song, and Steve...
That's Atlantic City, I
think. Yeah, Buffalo Nickel is the name of the song.
Right.
And that was the kind of thing. They were very responsive, and the producer, who later fell afoul of the law...
Garth Drabinski,
yeah. Gave me everything I wanted. You know, I said, this scene looks kind of cheap. And he would go out and get someone to do huge projections to give the scene some depth. And suddenly you're just looking at Penn Station in all its glory. He didn't stint.
Terrence McNally said that the weekly nut on it was so high that it needed like virtually a sold-out audience to even break even.
Yeah.
Because of that.
Well, I think it probably would have... It ran for 2 years, yeah. But if not for the... backstage financial difficulties, the corporate difficulties that Garth got into with his newer investors, who then took the company over from him. If not for that, the show would have run for 5 or 6 years, because the audiences loved the show, but the minute Garth was out of there, the marketing ended because the new investors were so hurt and angry at the way he cooked the books, or allegedly cooked the book. They lost their verve for the piece. And that's why it closed, I think, because it did fill the theater.
E.L. Doctorow, did you have any dealings on either the movie of Billy Bathgate or Welcome to Hard Times?
No. With Welcome to Hard Times, I had a talk with Henry Fonda, who had high hopes for the film, but turned out to have no control over it. I didn't write it. I just went to a screening. It was the first time I had anything to do with it. And, of course, was appalled. It's the second worst film ever to come out of Hollywood, that picture.
What do you think is the worst?
The first?
Yeah.
That's a picture called Swamp Fire with Johnny Weissmuller. But, you know, years later, Fonda was asked, that French film cineast magazine, what his greatest professional disappointment was. And he said, Welcome to Hard Times. He thought it was going to be another Oxbow incident. I knew that was a dangerous thought when he said that.
Well, E.L. Doctorow, you began your career. Your first novel was Welcome to Hard Times. And prior to that, you'd been a staff reader for a film company. What was the film company?
Columbia Pictures, now Sony.
And you said
that
about...
That was good training, you know.
It
you,
was?
You read a book a day and wrote a synopsis and then a comment as to whether it would make a film or not. And then you sent your pages up to the executives who didn't have time to read or perhaps couldn't read. And they read your story that you converted from the book you were doing. In fact, that's how Welcome to Hard Times got written, because this was in the late 50s and Westerns were very popular then. And I had to read a lot of lousy Westerns, and I wrote what I thought was a parody story of the Westerns. And someone said, this is good, you will turn it into a novel. So I took that story and crossed out the title and wrote chapter one and continued from there. And then I got serious about the book. I thought I could use work in counterpoint to the reader's expectations of the genre and do something pretty serious.
Had you done any novel writing, any attempted novel writing or short story writing prior to that?
Yes, I was struggling. I was quite young at the time and struggling with an autobiographical novel that wasn't going anywhere. And this taught me a lesson. Whatever you're planning, whatever you're outlining, whatever you're researching, whatever you're struggling with, none of that is writing. Every book begins then from some sort of creative accent, whether I was working for a film company, whether in the case of Loon Lake I was driving in the Adirondacks and saw a sign that said Loon Lake. And without any great planning or intention, you write to find out what it is you're writing and make these same discoveries if it turns into a book that the reader will make. So you're both the writer and the reader at the same time.
Is there an outlining process for you?
None.
What attracted you, had you always been interested in learning about the Rosenbergs for the Book of Daniel?
Well, in that case, I hadn't paid much attention to the case when it was going on. And when they were executed, I was serving in the army in Germany in 1954. And then in the late 60s, when everything broke out, in the student rebellions and the anti-war movement and the civil rights movement, and this new left phenomenon sprung up out of the colleges, I began to think what the difference was between the new radicalism and the old radicalism, the spontaneous anti-intellectual, in many cases, organized dissent, as opposed to the 30s form, where the communists, who did a lot of good work organizing labor unions and in fighting for civil rights in the South, they were all run overseas, and they were highly intellectual. They had theory. So I thought maybe there's a book in that difference between the new left and the old left, and then I realized that maybe a fulcrum for that would be the Rosenberg case. So I read some news stories and files and transcripts, and then I got to work. But it didn't go well at the beginning, and we come back to voice now. I wrote about 150 pages of that book, and they're terrible. They were awful. And I thought, I threw them across the room. I thought, I don't deserve to be a writer if I could take material like this and make it boring. And in an act of sort of mockery of my own pretense as a writer, own presumption, I start to write something else, and it turned out to be the first page of the book of Daniel. And the moral of that story was that I shouldn't write the book, Daniel should write it. Once I had him, the book just flowed.
So every book on some level needs that moment when suddenly it clicks.
Yeah. If you're lucky, it happens right away. Then you get that voice right away. In the case of Daniel, it took me about 6 months of bad work to find a way to do it.
What of ragtime? I recall at the time the reviewers talking about the way you had used fictional and non-fictional characters and intermingled them as some kind of revolutionary practice. But it's been done before.
Sure it has. It was done back in the 18th century.
Yeah.
When I was a kid, I would read The Count of Monte Cristo or The Three Musketeers. Cardinal Richelieu was a character. And the kings in Tolstoy's War and Peace, Napoleon is a character. But apparently there was some way I was doing that people felt was new, and it did kind of open the floodgates, because a lot of people started to fiction writers to use historical characters, felt entitled to intrude in the sacred realm of actual names and events.
I mentioned before the voice of ragtime, which is what grabbed me, and I think grabbed most of the readers within a page or two. Was that something that took a while to do, or was that also, or was that quick?
That was the book I wrote after Daniel,
yeah.
And I was emotionally exhausted by Daniel and didn't realize it, and kept writing and couldn't get anywhere for about a year. And at that time, we were living in New Rochelle in an old house. I had a study up on the third floor, and I was staring at the wall, so I start to write about the wall. That's the kind of day you have sometimes. And the house it was attached to, it was built in 1906. It's top of the Broadview Avenue Hill. Well, what did things look like in 1906? Well, down on North Avenue, there were the trolleys going down to the Long Island Sound, and there's no air conditioning. People wore white clothes and carried parasols against the sun, and men had straw boaters. And there was a kind of insularity of the upper middle class, and so that black people were invisible and immigrants non-existent. Teddy Roosevelt was president, and one image followed another, and I was off the wall and into the book.
The Sweetland Stories, now that you are becoming more familiar with working within that form, do you plan to continue writing stories?
Well, I don't know. These things come to you, and then you do them. I'm working on a novel now. It'll probably take me through the fall, and then we'll see.
You've been listening to an interview with E.L. Doctorow, whose latest book is a collection of short stories, Sweetland Stories. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.